And welcome back to Dr. Drill's Making Motivation podcast, where it is our mission to honor interesting and authentic people and tell their highly motivating stories. Check it out, my friends. Today is the 19th of May in the year 2024. I've got my good friend Chris Garana with me. He's a former Marine. He is a mortarman by trade and did some time in security forces. Two enlistments and three deployments to Afghanistan and twice to Iraq. But it's his story to tell, so I'm comfortable handing over the reins to Chris. Welcome.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming on the Making Motivation podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We got some show and tell. Oh, it's an honor, man. We got some show and tell behind Chris. But I want to start from the get-go, my brother. Like, where are you from? How'd you find your way in the military? And why the Marine Corps? What were your experiences? Tell us your story.
Why the Marine Corps is I always wanted to be a Marine, that or a cop, but a Marine more so. From Hatfield here, went to North Penn, graduated 03. And then from there, I signed up or not. Sorry, I didn't sign up. I was in a relationship and I was like, if this relationship ends, I'm going in the Marines, which I mean, is a high school relationship. So
it did.
Yeah. So as soon as it ended, I went and signed up and I finished high school. I was supposed to leave in the summertime. I went in on the buddy program. So we ended up getting pushed back to December, went to boot camp. And then my buddy at boot camp dropped out. So then it was just me, the more buddy program.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened to him?
He had some health, herniated discs type stuff that he tried to just work through and he couldn't
do
it. Boot camp was coming down on him. So he ended up getting out. I kind of resented that for a while, but it's just he was hurt.
So he got recycled and MRP, or he didn't go in at all.
No, he didn't. Yeah, he came back home. He came back to Lansdale.
Okay.
Yeah, he got, I guess, MedCept or
yeah,
whatever they do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was actually really hard for me to get in. I had to go to MEPS 3 times.
Why?
Because in high school at North Penn, I broke both the bones in my shin, and they had to put a rod in to put my shin back together.
How did that happen?
And it playing football.
Okay.
Yeah, against freaking CB West.
What was your position?
I was a power wing and outside linebacker. I was powered because I wasn't fast enough to be a running back, but I wasn't big enough to be a fullback. So, freaking power wings like a hybrid.
Yeah.
But it happened on a kickoff, running down the guy next to me. I went to cut towards the guy with the ball. So my leg was kind of straightened at an angle. The guy next to me got blocked from the side, fell down, came through, and just went straight through my shin. Just both the bones just completely snapped.
So they gave you some shit about that at MAPS, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, they gave me a lot of shit. I had me in front of a special doctor jumping up and down on one leg.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But if we weren't fighting two wars at the time, I wouldn't have been able to get in. Today's enlistment standards, I probably wouldn't have been able to get in.
Yeah.
Now, it is hard for them recruiting, so maybe there would have been a small shot, but they gave me a real hard time. Yeah. We were fighting two wars at the time.
Jesus. Yeah, MEPS sucks too. So 3 times at MEPS.
Yeah.
That's a spirit killer. So you really wanted to join.
Yeah. Recruiter picking me up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, I'm sure he was over it. Oh my God. Yeah, right. But you got in. So you go down to Paris Island. What was that experience like for you?
I honestly enjoyed it. I mean, the first week or two when they're really putting you through it, that sucked. But overall, once you get past that first 2 weeks, I enjoyed it. I love the physical aspect. I love it was always a challenge of me versus the drill instructors, them trying to count down and everything and me being you're not going to beat me, which is exactly what they want.
Right.
Yeah. And then they would send you up to the quarter deck or whatever if you got in trouble. So I enjoyed that. It got to the end, me and the other squad leaders and the guide, probably the last month or so, we were in such good shape that they would send people to the sand pits And it wasn't us, but we would go voluntarily. So we were just voluntarily going to the sand pits, and the drill instructors would end up kicking us out of the sand pits because we enjoyed it. It was just it was a workout, you know.
You won, like, man.
Yeah, as far as like mental wise, you know, like if you don't let it get to you, like that's it. Like they can't beat you.
So now what inspired you? And you see, you always want to be a Marine. Me too. But was there a person? Was there a persona?
No, I don't think there was a. Probably the persona, just like the, you know, the old commercial with like the guy slaying the dragon and going up the mountain and the fire and everything. Like a lot of people laugh at it, but man, I was like, man, like that would be awesome.
They figured it out. That's why I've talked to other Marines about it. I don't know. There's got to be somebody. There's got to be a story behind the Marine Corps recruiting where they figured out, like, our angle is going to be, maybe you can't do this. This is going to be fucking terrible. You really want to be the best. Not everybody, a few of the proud, not everybody can do this. Do you have what it takes? And then for the young man, oh man, that's especially if you're like, again, you got a relationship, you're like your hometown. I want to get out. I want to do something special.
Right.
So it's really built for the young, you know, young men, testosterone, challenge me, let's go.
Yeah. And I saw a guy had like a YouTube video. Or like one of those reels or something, and he was showing like the commercials of the other branches, yeah. And they're very just like, you know, plain and whatever. And then like here's the Marines with a dragon and fire and a guy climbing and like all kinds of stuff. And
yeah,
there's just it was a good comparison. It's funny, but yeah, just the Marines is always just appealing to me. The challenge, like I perceive them to be like, if you're gonna go in the military, like that's the hardest branch to do. So yeah. Just always appealing.
Definitely, man. Same. So did you go in 03/11?
I went in 03 open, 03XX.
Okay.
I tried to get contract 03/11, but they wouldn't do that. And then so fast forward and I was in SOI and they made me a damn mortarman. And I was like, no, I was like, this is terrible. I don't want to be a mortarman. So I found a guy that was an 11 that wanted to be a mortarman, and I was a mortarman, and I took him to the instructors and I was like, dude, he wants to be a 41. I want to be an 11. Like, let us switch. And they thought about it for like 2 seconds. And then they're like, no, like you are what you are. I was like, damn it. I ended up loving mortars.
Yeah. It seemed to be like a pretty cool job.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's just, you know, when I joined and everything, in my mind, I wanted to be an 11.
Yeah.
I didn't want to deviate from that. But yeah.
So now 60s?
Yeah.
Or 60s. Yep. Yeah. All I know about 60s is, you know, some of the training that we would do periodic, obviously call for fire training and squad leaders course. We had to learn all the weaponry there. So,
yeah, it's cool. It's fun. I really like the 60s, but it's just annoying too, because like it's so small and fragile. If you fart too hard, the thing's going to get freaking knocked out of whack. Whereas like 81s. You know, they're bigger, they're tough. So like you could bump it and you're not going to move it that much. But the 60s, like any little knock or whatever in the tube, like say you're putting the round in and like you shake it just a little bit, like things freaking could be going like the way wrong direction.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're finicky.
That's interesting. You see how I, for the viewer, I, came up with a little, I'm trying to title this podcast, and, I said, be bold in bracket. That's all I knew about.
Yeah.
The
words, yeah.
Right. They would,
and yep.
What does that mean to the viewer? Be bold in bracket. When you're a mortar, what is a mortar?
Mortar is, I mean, to put it easy, like a grenade on steroids. And it's just, you know, how you throw a grenade with your arm, we just drop it down a tube and then it, you know, indirect fire goes up, arcs, whatever. You put the information on the M64A1, still remember the sight unit. You put the information on the sight unit, get that up on the stake, and then drop it. And then, you know, the round will land. From there, they make adjustments. Say, you know, you're over by 100 or whatever. Like, you take away 100. If you're still too far, like you're too far back now, you'll add, like, 50.
Right.
And then fire for effect.
Yeah. Which means you're dropping all kinds of 60, all kinds of munitions in there, right?
One after the other. Yeah.
So they call them a mortar section, correct?
Yep.
So how many guys are in a section?
I think there was, what, like 10 or 11 of us? depending. Yeah, because we had three on each gun. Yeah, section leader and then a FDC.
Okay.
So it kind of depends. Sometimes we had maybe like 12.
And how many mortar tubes are in that?
Three. You have three guns.
Okay.
Yeah, gun one, two, and three. Gun two is always the adjust gun. You go off of that, and then so that gun will shoot the rounds until they get on target, and then when you get on target, all three guns will fire for effect.
Okay, that's pretty cool. What is it? What's something interesting about being a mortarman that that might, you know, know?
What I would say, probably this applies only to 60s. You can't do it with 81s, but they have handheld mode. So you can, you know, strip away a system and it's just the tube. And then we call it the baby base plate. And you just run around. There's a range indicator on the handle and you just hold it and you kind of, you watch the little bubble and you go back and forth until it's the range you want. And then there's a trigger on there and you, you pull the trigger and that, and that's how you fire the round that way. So, I mean, that can be wildly inaccurate, but you know, if you're fighting a good amount of guys, like in Iraq or Afghanistan, it's pretty wide open. Then, I mean, it could be really useful. I actually, one time we were at CACS, this was when I had been in for a good bit then, I messed around with trying to keep the bipods on there by using the baby base plate. So I would keep the bipods on the tube, but just like not, not have the cable like taut or anything. And I raced the guy. So he had it in regular handheld mode and I had it with the bipods like modified version, and we ran up and I set up the bipods and no like sight or anything, but I was just trying to see if using the bipods would be faster and more effective than like just trying to use, because you can adjust using handheld mode, but you're working off yourself, so you can still be wildly inaccurate even if you're trying to adjust because you're holding it. Whereas the bipods are helping the center now. So like if I had to make an adjustment, I could just crank on the wheel a bunch and this a bunch and then, you know, change pretty drastically like where I'm shooting around. And if it was somewhat accurate, then just fire for effect myself.
Yeah.
So it was fun. We had some fun with it. Our section was really good. We were the best in the battalion.
That's awesome, dude.
Other guys might try to argue that, but I would argue with other guys that none of them had a guy that won a case of beer from the battalion gunner. So until they do that, they can't claim that they're the best section.
That's awesome. What kind of munitions, I remember vaguely in squad leader school where they had the propellant, right? They're like little rings that are loaded on there.
Yep.
And how much you have to set that yourself, or that comes?
Yeah, the FDC will tell you. Because it's you got like charge 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, I think was the max. Yeah. And that's when you're shooting far out. So that all that'll come from the FDC, but it's basically however many rings on there changes how hard it shoots out, which is going to help. Like if you have to shoot farther, you're going to charge 4. If you're shooting closer, you're going to charge 0.
Yeah. I bet you can make a freaking kick ass potato gun.
Yeah, probably.
I made one back in the day. Fucking grill igniter is the greatest thing.
Really?
That's the closest thing I ever got to a mortar, though. I mean, they did a little bit of it. They let us fire a couple rounds in squad leader school. But yeah, potato gun. My innovation was at the end of it, I friggin' took like a triangular file and I kind of like serrated it so that the potato would like. And fucking just get a real nice tight seal and I jam that bitch down and I hit that grill igniter, spray a little hairnet in there. pretty friggin' cool, dude, being part. I remember humping the every once in a while they'd on a hump or whatever, we wound up carrying a mortar base plate. They just throw it around just to fucking torture somebody.
Really? Yeah. As an 11?
Yeah, they distribute it out there or something like that. If somebody's having a tough time.
If somebody had one of our friggin' base plates,
sacrilegious.
Then somebody in the mortar section is getting choke slammed.
Really?
Because we carry our shit.
Handle your own shit.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
If a guy's actually, it's happened where like a guy's falling out and he's carrying the base plate, and then now I got my pack and some part of the system and his freaking like the base plate or whatever he was carrying, and now he just has his pack, so he's not falling out.
So that's a cardinal sin. to for somebody else to carry your shit.
Yeah, no, yeah, nobody so was.
Everything has gone to shit if somebody else is carrying a mortar section.
Yeah, I'll have the whole damn system myself before somebody else is carrying our stuff.
I love that. I think it was probably a function of like, hey, we're going to, it's probably in like SOI or something like here. Give this fuck.
Yeah.
Shit. We're going to torture this guy with a mortar base plate. But that's cool. Kind of like breaking ranks, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah.
Very cool. Okay. So you're a mortarman. You're, what was the unit you served in?
3-3, 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines.
And they were out of Lejeune?
Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was cool. It was, you know, really nice when we were back. We spent probably most of our time in either California, Iraq, or Afghanistan. But when we were back, it was nice. Definitely, like, I would drive to the beach sometimes, like, at night and just turn my radio up and sit on the beach after deployments and just try to, like, decompress. Yeah. And it was just, you'd be the only one there. And it was really nice. So that was definitely a huge advantage to being in Hawaii. But other than that, I mean, we just go out in town, drink,
fight. Yeah. Same thing. It could be could be friggin' Camp Lejeune, or it could be Hawaii. You're still gonna do Marines are gonna be Marines.
Yeah, except in Hawaii they're freaking really big. So
what are
the locals?
Oh yeah, yeah. I get to get some stories about that tangle with the locals.
Yeah.
So you're in Hawaii. You're serving with 3-3. You tell me about the deployments.
First one was to Afghan. That was from 2004 to 2005. And then Iraq, 2006. And then Iraq again from 2007 to 2008. I had to extend for that one. And then I re-enlisted on top of my extension. Deployments, first one was quiet for the most part. But there was like a really big firefight in May. Yeah, May of 05. We lost a couple guys in that, but it was like, I think we lost two guys and they killed like 25, 26 insurgents, something like that.
Yeah.
So it was a lot going on. They had A-10s coming in doing gun runs and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And then my first one to Iraq, that was like the Wild Wild West, where we were getting kind of shot at, lots of IEDs, lots of mortars. We had a pretty small base. I think it was previously like a school, but wherever they shot from, like, they had us freaking zoned in because they dropped mortars right in the damn middle. Actually, one time the battalion commander came and we were having like a big meeting inside and they mortared us at the time. And one of them dropped like right next to my truck, but they dropped like two or three, like right in the middle of the fob, to where if the battalion commander wasn't there and people were outside, like, it actually probably would have been pretty devastating. So we were lucky that the battalion commander was there and everybody was inside. Mm-hmm. And that was right after, like, I don't know if you remember or heard about the whole Haditha massacre thing when guys from, I forget what unit it was, but they had got hit by an IED and then they kind of went nuts on the town and killed civilians, and it wasn't a good thing. So we took over for that battalion. So the locals there where I was in Iraq freaking hated us. It didn't matter if we were that battalion or not. So we had an idea that we were going to be in for a long deployment. And then my third one, quiet. The reason I went on my third one is because we would have such influx of like new guys coming in, old guys going out. And with my platoon, it was so drastic that when I extended to go, my best friend also extended. And one of my stipulations was he's going to be in my squad. So, because we were the only ones in our platoon that had done two deployments previous. Everyone else had only done one. So it was me and him that had done previous deployments. And then other than that, the other eight or nine guys, it was all their first deployment. Like, that's how drastic the numbers were. So if me and him didn't extend, they'd have been even thinner on guys with experience. And I just, like, me sitting at home, I couldn't imagine like watching the news and these guys are, you know, going through shit and they got all these new guys where like, yeah, you're a Marine, but there's a big difference between, you know, Marine Day 280 and Marine Day freaking, you know, 1,000,
right,
with the previous deployments and everything. So me and him extended, and it was good. It was good for them. And then towards the end, I was able to kind of start transitioning out from being like the squad leader, and I would have them start to do like the patrol briefs, and I would just like sit in the back. You know, if they were like missing something or something else needed to get talked about, then like I would just ask questions and try to guide them. But I wanted them to be able to start learning how to run things because I knew I wouldn't be on the next deployment. So it was good. They all did really well, really, really well.
Who were some of the guys you served with who were in your section there that you remember? You remember all of them, huh?
Yeah, a lot of them.
So tell me about your best friend there.
Lee, he was a good dude. He was actually a machine gunner. I think he started off as a 51 and then went to a machine gunner in the fleet. But me and him just hung out all the time, real good guy. In the beginning, I think we actually didn't like each other for whatever reason. I can't even remember now. But somehow something happened and we ended up being, you know, best friends and hanging out all the time and stuff. And, we had a really good friendship, but then also a really good working relationship to where, like, if I said something, he might give me a little shit, but then, he would listen. Like, he would understand, like, all right, you know, G's the one in charge. Like, I can't, if I give him all this shit, the guys are going to think that they can too. And he's going to end up fucking choke slamming somebody.
Right.
So we had a really good friendship, really good working relationship. Marchese was definitely the funniest because that guy has stories for days. I love being with Marchese. Him and I, so many stories with him about, like, I didn't have an iPod or whatever at the time. So he did, and we would lay in the tent at night and we'd listen to Billy Joel, and he would have in like the right earbud and I would have in the left and stuff. Just fun times. Like one time our tent blew down the freaking range. I thought he was holding it. I guess he thought I was holding it. It was real windy. We both let go and the tent's blowing down the mortar range and we're standing there like looking at each other arguing. Meanwhile, the tent's just blowing down the range and somebody from like down the range ran and chased after it and actually got it because him and I were standing there arguing about it so much.
Yeah.
It was just fun. It's fun times. He got kicked out of Canada.
What?
Something to do with get in trouble while you're drinking.
Oh God, yeah. The bond, man. That's one of the things that is a common thread with all of, and one of my favorite parts of the podcast is talking about, you know, the men we served with and the experiences we had and the fact that it's not like we could just come and go as we please. We had to be there. And when you're there and, you know, you do shit like that, you listen to Billy Joel, you with a friggin' earpiece in one side and me in the other, and you become close and you know everything about your brothers.
Yeah.
And that's a really special thing that is not as common in the civilian sector, right?
No, it's impossible to try and recreate that camaraderie in the civilian side. I mean, something like police, fire, something along those lines, probably be the closest. But even still, I don't know that it can mimic the camaraderie that happens in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
I mean, that's my friends and I still, get together like every couple of years. Over COVID, we went to, Breckenridge, Colorado. We did like a little ski trip and stuff, rented a house out there. And like my buddy from Louisiana, who's barely seen snow in his life, didn't go skiing. But like a couple of us did, but we were in a house for, you know, 4 or 5 days, catching up, bullshitting, hanging out, laughing, stuff like that. It's good. It's best kind of therapy that you can have. I know we were talking about that earlier. It's just seeing, having reunions. Actually, my old unit is having a reunion next week, I think. And I wish I could have went, but I'm going to Ireland the following weekend.
Yeah.
I just couldn't swing being away for 2 weekends in a row.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough. Next time.
Yeah.
So the deployments, you mentioned here that there were some highlights to the deployments. Any cool stories you have about that? I know you mentioned here that there was an IED.
I'm trying to think of which IED. Oh, just the first one.
Holloway in the door.
Yeah, that was that Holloway in the door actually wasn't a deployment. That was when we were training at CAX. We were boots and we went to CAX. We were getting ready for Afghanistan. And we go up to the door and the guys are like interacting with, you know, the locals, the training people. And all of a sudden things get like real hostile. And the first like two, three guys, whatever, in front of me get shot with sim rounds and they're all down. So then it was me, like PFC boot that was right there. And so I ran up on the far side of the door and I was just kind of like, you know, popping shots in with the sim rounds and stuff. And I yelled out like, cause there's three or four of them in there. I was like, we need more firepower. So I yelled down to the guys like on the street, like, you know, get me a SAW or a 240 up here. So my buddy Ed Holloway comes running up, funny guy, lives in Texas now, but like a country guy from Ohio, like big dip in his mouth with his freaking SAW. He's on the other side of the door. We're freaking, you know, booties can be. And he's like, what do you want me to do? And I was like, spray that effing hallway. So he's like, all right. And I don't, instead of having any kind of like tactical approach or whatever you would normally do, he goes from like, you know, right shoulder against the doorway, puts his left leg up in the air, like he's getting on a horse and comes down and lands like right in the middle of the doorway with the SAW on his hip, just going. And I'm standing there and I'm watching this happen. And it's funny because he's shooting so many dang rounds, but in the back of my mind, I'm like, why the hell did he put his leg in the air like that? Like he's getting on a damn horse and land right in the middle of the doorway. So it was fun. After that, you know, like the more senior guys were able to make their way up and go into the house and everything. But yeah, that's one of the more fun.
It sticks with you, right? Oh, yeah. The humor, man, is friggin' next level. And then you wrote their ID, the gym in Iraq.
Yeah, the gym. What was a good idea is like we always had a gym, no matter how small our base was. And I think they knew like that was just a good, healthy way to blow off steam.
Oh, yeah.
No. So like we would get back from patrol sometimes at like 2 o'clock in the morning and we'd be wide awake and probably like four or five of us would go to the gym and just be lifting at like 2 o'clock in the morning. That's my second deployment. It was like, get shot at, blown up, go to the gym. That's about the rotation we had.
Yeah. Yeah. The gym, definitely a good way to blow off freaking steam, man. And it's train how you're going to fight. So get in there and take your frustrations out there. So tell me about the IED.
The IED, trying to think of which one I was talking about. It was probably the first one. We were traveling in a high back in Afghanistan and we were up in the mountains and it was really cold. And so like guys had put their Gore-Tex and stuff on because it was either snowing or raining or going back and forth. And you're in a high back, so there's no cover, there's no top. So whatever precipitation's coming down, like you're catching that. And because I had the mortar system, I had a 9mm on my side. So I was like, all right, well, I don't want to take like my 9mm because that was on my belt and everything. It's like, I don't want to take all that off. So I'm just going to pull my Gore-Tex like up to my knees and sit there like that.
Right.
Well, I didn't think ahead enough and we got hit with a freaking IED. So now I'm stuck with my damn Gore-Tex around my knees and I'm trying to get the Gore-Tex off my, like over my boots and down off so I can jump out of the truck and get the mortar system. So it was a funny time to be like, shit, like I wish I had thought of forward for this.
So was that part where was that like you're in a convoy or
yeah we were on a convoy to we used to take a it'd be a platoon and then like a section of or a gun team from like machine gunners, mortars, and we would go out on like 10-day ops in different parts of our AO because I think our AO was pretty big. I mean, we would drive for like 2 hours. Yes, we were up in the mountains. So we'd stay out there for like 10 days running ops and stuff like that and then go back. So it would have been on our way out, I think, that we got hit with the IED.
Tell me about notable Marines you served with. I asked you about that. You said Dakota Meyer was.
Yeah, I meant to text my buddy actually and ask him. I don't know. It was after I had left. But I know he received the Medal of Honor, and I was doing his ceremony in D.C. And then I was at like a bar across the street hanging out, and some guys from like my old unit came up, and I was like, "Oh, I was like, dude, like, what the hell are you doing here?" They said that they were there for the Dakota Meyer thing. So I guess I forget how he was affiliated with 3-3, but he was in 3-3 somehow. I don't think it was when he got the Medal of Honor for when he received that, but I'm not sure where I was going at the time.
Yeah.
But other than that, I can't think off the top of my head.
How about leaders that you remember and respected, looked up to as a boot? Let's say you show up, and across that time, the chain of command, guys that you remember that inspired you.
When I first got to the fleet, a guy named Kirvin was there. He was a Lance Corporal, but the rest of our company was in Australia at the time, so it was just, you know, this boot drop of like 30 guys or so, and then Kirvin, and Kirvin was in shape, and so he would take us on like a 4 or 5 mile run every morning, then we would go eat lunch, and then he would take us to the pool because he was a McQuist guy.
Yeah.
And my God, did we get freaking hazed in the pool. I never looked at swimming the same way. I went from like barely being able to tread water in boot camp using my muscles to being able to tread water for 2 hours passing bricks and rubber rifles.
Yeah, it's awesome to have somebody like that pushing you guys out.
Yeah.
Not at the time, it felt like hell, right?
I liked it though. I just liked the physical challenges.
Yeah.
And you know, him and I, like he would pick me to like kind of lead the platoon on like the run to the pool and stuff. Like I liked him, and you know, I think he liked me. Like we had a general like respect for each other, and like he would do the room inspections, and you know, he would come in and be like, "Gee, like why can you clean your room better yourself than these guys can with two people?" You know, Lance Corporal, I don't know. but yeah, he was really, really good dude. But so he was one of the ones when we went to Afghanistan, he was one of the ones that got killed. So that after Afghan, like that busted me up pretty hard because I looked up to him a lot, like an older brother. Yeah, it took me probably even like 3 years to even like accept, you know, that he got killed and stuff. Mm. But I had you know, some good, really good leadership from, you know, lieutenants, captains, lieutenant colonels, first sergeants, gunnies. One of them, you know, First Sergeant Burke, he got out, Sergeant Major Burke, but he'll always stick out in my mind because I got kicked out of sergeant's course my first time. And he came to my door, you know, and rather than try to, you know, NJP me or give me a negative fit rep or, you know, whatever have you, like book wise, you know, he came to me, he's like, "Sergeant G, I know this isn't you, like what's going on?" So that's when I finally, like, I broke down to him and I was like, you know, first one, I can't sleep at night. Like everywhere I go, I picture mortars. Like I basically couldn't shut Iraq off in my mind. And I was using alcohol to try and do it, or I was drinking myself to sleep because that's one of the only ways I could sleep. So that's actually why I brought the sword, because the first time I got kicked out of sergeant's course, and then the second time when I had to go back, I got honor graduate, and I got the sword for being honor graduate for the second
time. That's fucking awesome, dude. Let's see the sword. Break that sucker out.
What was even funnier was I didn't even really want to be there, and I wasn't motivated, and there was guys that were like motivated and like leading and doing all this stuff. There were 107 people in the class.
Okay.
I just wanted to graduate the course this time, and then somehow I came out honor graduate. And I mean, I don't know, it was pretty cool. But let's see,
that's beautiful, man. Anything.
Yeah, you see, I see honor graduate for TAC 11.
That's outstanding, man. I always wanted one of those. I never got it.
Yeah, so
it's beautiful, fun. And I never
figured. I didn't know if you had seen a sword in a while or not, but figured I'd bring this in. It was cool because
that's beautiful, man.
The first time I got kicked out for, you know, alcohol related stuff.
That was a circumstance.
Yeah, I showed up late and still drunk to a PFT, and that was the second time I'd done that. So the second time I did it, they had to kick me out. And then first time Burke was more concerned about getting me the help I needed versus getting me in trouble. So from what I understand, he talked to the first sergeant over there, and instead of them kicking me out, they made it so my unit recalled me. So it looked a lot different on paperwork. And then from there, he told me to go see my psychiatrist because I had been seeing somebody since we got back 2006 from Iraq, our first time. And then the command was well aware of it. Like on my third deployment, even they made sure that I could go see like the chaplain once in a while to try and keep up with some things. So I went and saw my psychiatrist, who was an Air Force lady. She's great. She was like, you know, are you ready to go in the hospital for PTSD? And I was like, I don't have PTSD. She's like, yes, you do. Like, so, you know, we're going back and forth. And I was like, all right, fine. So I ended up doing a 7-week inpatient program, which, you know, I was really hesitant about doing it, but it was interesting because a lot of the guys in there were guys that I was with. So that kind of made it a lot easier to accept and kind of do because I had known the guys.
You too, huh? You know, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like a little freaking reunion almost.
Yeah.
So that helped me out a lot. Big time. That's probably one of the first things actually that saved my life in like a long list of them.
Yeah. So one of the things that are on our agenda, our mission today to the viewer is Chris is actually an author in the making. He's got a book underway that is called Alcohol, The War After Iraq. And so with all of the foundation laid, Chris, about your service and your experiences and the deployments, tell us about that book and the mission you're on.
So I had battled alcohol. Ever since when I first got to the fleet, I actually got NJP'd for underage drinking. Nothing happened out in town. I essentially just got narked out by somebody. Why? I don't know. Because I got narked out, they had to NJP me at that point. So that was like my first incident with alcohol in the Marine Corps. And I mean, I wasn't even 21 yet. And then from there, like I just kind of went back and forth. We would drink because we were out in town. We would drink because it was Saturday. We would drink because we were done a hump. You know, we would drink because after the deployments, then it became like a crutch almost. So I was in trouble with alcohol. I think I was counting it up the other day, like 4 different times. We would always, you know, like make sure that, so say a guy was like, you know, too drunk in the morning, but you have everybody there to like get him the formation and stuff and like get them there. So we kind of get used to that mentality. But then when you move on, like I had issues at 8th and I. And the way I tried to deal with it was, well, I'm not going to go home to Alexandria. So I had the guys bring a cot up to my office, and I would go to the bar, and then I would go to my cot in the office and sleep because I'm like, well, I can't be late because I'm already here. So I would just try to get up and, you know, get rid of the cot in the morning before people started coming in. So you really get used to that alcohol affiliated environment. But then when you get out of the Marines or the military in general, you know, things are drastically different. Most people don't drink like you do. And so I ran into a lot of issues when I got out. But even when I got in, or when I was still in, you know, like I went out in town one time after an event. So I used to do a lot of work with a program called TAPS. It's a Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. And we worked with the families of service members that died while they were in. It wasn't just Iraq or Afghanistan. It was, you know, suicide, heart attack, like whatever have you. I worked on the kids' side. They had professionals for, you know, like the adults, the widows, survivors, stuff like that. So one time they had a big event and there was two actors there. And I wasn't really like starstruck, but my buddies were all like, oh, like, you know, come on, they're going to go out with us. We're going to go bar hopping. I had a sergeant major changeover the next day. And I was like, all right, like I'll come out for one or two. And then that's it. Like, I got to go. Like, I have a sergeant major changeover tomorrow. I cannot miss that. And I had to be in front of the platoon, like doing things. Well, it went from I'll come out and have one or two to at 9 a.m. the next day, I have freaking 40 missed calls, you know, 60 text messages saying like, you better be dead or in the hospital.
Oh no.
Yeah. So, and for that, so I'm thankful that I didn't get in trouble for that. Like they kind of, I got reamed really good. But I didn't get in trouble. I didn't get NJP'd. I didn't get a page 11 or anything like that. So, you know, while you're thankful that didn't happen, it kind of, you kind of don't learn from it because you got away with it essentially.
Right.
So one of the things that I would like to do, to try and help identify guys that are in, that are struggling with alcohol, because my four different times I got in trouble, I had different commands. So other than the NJP, nobody really knew that I could be struggling with alcohol because it got swept under the rug and it was with a different command. So the new command comes in. They don't know anything because there's no paperwork on it, you know? So then I get in trouble with them, like something alcohol related. And then the same thing, like that command leaves. So you have a pattern of getting in trouble with, you know, like alcohol incidents, but nobody really knows because of the command changeovers. So I would like to see, and you know, this is like far down the line, but it makes sense to me if you have some sort of alcohol related incident that you don't necessarily get in trouble, because I don't want to see guys' careers ruined over it. Like,
which happens.
Yeah. And I'm like PTSD, even they're not supposed to hold that against you. But they do. And I know that from personal experience, as far as like with a clearance and stuff. Like, I definitely know that from personal experience. But like, why can't we report it to medical? Because your medical is the one thing that stays with you throughout your time in the military. And it's, they can't look into it. And it's not going to go against you as far as like your career and stuff like that. But say you have an alcohol related incident, you got to go to medical. Like, they just sit down and talk to you, you know, like kind of like we are, like, all right, is this a habitual thing, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then down the road, like, you have another one and you could try to let it go, the person, whoever is talking to you, but they'll be like, well, you know, it says in here that 8 months ago you were here for another alcohol related incident. Like, why, how am I going to think that this isn't a pattern? And like, you know, with every alcohol related incident, they give you like a more treatment. So like it goes from like, you know, a counseling to this time you have to do a class or whatever, to this time to like, you know, four times within say like an 18 month period, like you got to go to rehab or something more serious because clearly you have an issue.
Yeah.
But there's no way to like track guys that could, you know, be potentially like have a very hard time with alcohol. And then when you get out, I mean,
not forget it,
like, you know, suicide and homelessness. Like if you think alcohol and drugs doesn't play a major role in that, you're nuts. I looked at something the other day and there's about 35,000 homeless veterans in the United States. And it's estimated that 3/4 of them struggle with some sort of substance abuse issue. And so my whole thing behind the book is, so I had trouble when I was in the military, but I still managed to have a good career because I always had people looking out for me. When I got out, I was a lot more on my own. And, you know, somebody stepped in, like I refer to him as my mentor all the time. He's like a dad to me. He stepped in and helped me out a lot. He probably saved my life on one instance. But you lose that. You lose a crutch that you're used to as far as people looking out for you and people, you know, making sure that you get to somewhere, wherever, or your buddies might try to talk to you, as far as like alcohol and stuff. But in the civilian side, you don't have that. So, you know, I lost my mind literally when I got out. And I was drinking all the time. I turned to drugs. My psychiatrist, it got to a point where she was like, you know, you're going upstairs for treatment. You're either going to do it a 302, which is involuntary, or a 201, which is voluntary. And I was like, what's the difference? And, you know, vaguely, she put it like, 302, you can't have a gun, 201, you can. And I was like, I'm going no matter what. And she's like, yeah. I was like, all right, I'll go 201, because I don't want to lose my ability to have the right to have a gun.
Right.
I knew I had a lot of issues going on at the time, but the reason she did that is because I was drinking and then going down to Philly and buying $1,000 worth of cocaine
at
3 o'clock in the morning with a guy that in a neighborhood where I couldn't get out of the car because I was white and they might think I was a cop and I could get shot at 3 o'clock in the morning. Like, so to me, my mind goes, well, this isn't dangerous. It's probably not a good idea. I go, well, I'm probably the only one without a gun. I should start looking at guns. So she said she thought I was trying to recreate Iraq. And, you know, I asked her like what she meant. She's like, you're used to that chaos, like that danger. Like that's where you feel comfortable. That's where you operate. So like that's how you know how to deal with situations. Being, you know, here in like civilian side, I felt, and for a lot of the time, I still feel kind of awkward, but it used to be way, way worse to where like I couldn't even function civilian side because I didn't know how to act at all. I was completely out of place. I went on a psych unit for like 5 or 6 days, and that helped for probably a good like couple months or so. But then, you know, I started back up and then started going again. And so I just went through periods of, you know, not periods, but I would drink a lot. Not always during the week, but when I would drink, I would drink till I was, you know, passed out, blacked out, whatever. And so I had issues with school because I went to school for construction, issues with work, issues with my daughter big time. You know, like I damaged our relationship to where when I finally stopped drinking, like I'm trying to repair that, and I am, but I have to understand that it takes time. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you hurt people using, you know, because you're using drugs, alcohol, stuff like that, just because you stop using that trauma or those memories that you put them through, that doesn't just go away. Like you have to earn people's trust back. I've always had an understanding of that. But you know, it takes time. But there's a lot of guys out there, like one of my friends, to where he got intoxicated one night and he went in his truck and shot himself in the head. And then, you know, now there's another funeral that I had to go to down in Louisiana.
Veteran.
Yeah. So the premise behind the book is, I know a good amount of guys, especially after I finally got sober, which was after a standoff with police when I had a gun to my head. Once I started talking about quitting drinking and stuff on like Facebook, or whatever, you know, and I just kind of put it out there, other guys started coming out of the woodworks, and guys that like I never thought would quit drinking. And, you know, so I would text him whatever, and it's like, why'd you quit drinking? And, you know, because he did something really drastic and it finally pushed him to stop. Or, you know, another guy, his wife was about to divorce him, so he stopped. But a lot of these guys, like, drugs and alcohol play so much of a role in homelessness and suicide. But the VA seems to really only focus on homelessness and suicide. They don't really go after the drugs and alcohol aspect so much, even though I feel like that's a major contributor to the other two. And that if you start to take that on a little bit, the numbers of homeless and, you know, people that take their lives would go down as like a byproduct to that. Now, you know, is that going to completely eliminate it? No. But are you going to make a lot of people's lives a lot better? Because, all right, you're not homeless. You don't take your life. Well, you could still go bankrupt. You could get divorced. You could lose custody of your kid. Like your life could be a living hell. So maybe now you're not suicidal, but down the road you might be. So, cause my life completely changed from when I was drinking and using alcohol to deal with a lot of things to when I finally said enough is enough. Like I'm finally done. And I stopped. I live a life that I never thought ever was going to be possible. Like never. And it's because I don't drink. Your mind clears up, your eyes clear up, like your emotions change. You're able to start dealing with some of the things that, some of the reasons that you would, you know, drink or use. Like I said, I've been in, you know, seeing a therapist or whatever since like 2006. From 2006 until, when did I stop drinking? 2023. Yeah, like 14 months ago. I had always thought I was working on myself, like trying to make myself better, but I wasn't. I was just trying to, I don't know how to say it. I was trying to survive. I wasn't making myself better. I was just trying to survive and not hit a point where I really took my life. So when I stopped drinking and I started working with a therapist, that's when I was actually able to start working on myself and dealing with things that I went through and looking back at, you know, past situations, past trauma, things like that, and dealing with them and processing them. And when I hit that point, that helped me even more so to not want to drink or do drugs. Now, like the life that I've been able to have being sober, that alone just makes me never want to go back to like drugs or alcohol in the slightest bit. Like sobriety is so much better that people can be, you know, drinking and having fun all around me and stuff. And, you know, other people are like, that doesn't bother you. I'm like, no, I don't care. Like, you know, listen, my issue is my issue. Like just cause I can't drink doesn't mean you can't drink and I'm not going to get all freaking upset about it because you're having a good time. Like you have a good time, like do what you do. But I'm not going to drink because I know what my life turns into and I'm never letting my life go back to that point. And so when I started talking about being sober for, you know, 6 months and stuff like that, guys started coming out of the woodworks and I was like, man, like, you know, there's actually a lot of us that have gone through a lot of shit that have come really close to taking our lives. You know, the Hatfield police, I told, hey, if you come to my house, I'm going to come outside with my gun and I'm going to make you shoot me and I can do it without having to fire around at you because I know what to do. And so they didn't. They staged, you know, down the road. My neighbor called me. He was like, dude, what the hell is going on? There's like four or five cop cars outside my house and they're all looking at your house. And I was like, yeah, man, like, you know, I'm going through something. Like, I'll talk to you about it tomorrow or whatever, you know, not knowing that if there would be a tomorrow or not, but I didn't feel like talking about it.
Right.
I'm on the phone at that moment. So in the end, I ended up calling my mentor, the one that I said is like a dad, like he's been there for me countless times. You know, and he got up out of bed, came to my house, and then the police intercepted him and said, like, listen, we don't advise you going in there. Like, he's an intoxicated veteran with PTSD and a gun. Like, it's an extremely dangerous situation. And he was like, I know he's not going to shoot me, and walked right in my house. And then, so when he came in, I gave him the, you know, the gun, and I just broke down. Because at that point, like, when I was at the bar that night, there was a calmness or like an acceptance that came over me. And it wasn't like, this is my life now, or this is just how I'm going to be for the rest of my life or anything like that. It was an acceptance of, I'm going to go home and shoot myself, and I'm all right with that. And that, that was probably the scary point, because that level of acceptance, like, it's hard for me to portray it to somebody, but it almost came with like a calmness and just an acceptance of like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it's going to finally end. So yeah, he came in, I went to the hospital for a couple of days. And believe it or not, actually, after that, I kept drinking. That's not what got me to quit drinking. And so there was something that happened down the line with a relationship where it was a couple months later. And at that point, I was like, all right, the issue with having the gun in my head, and then the issue with the relationship and that whole situation that happened, that's what drove me to say, like, all right, like, enough is enough. Like, something's got to fucking change. Like, either you're going to take your life or you got to quit. So I tried to quit first, and I started going to AA. I was apprehensive about it. I didn't know what to expect. But yeah, it turned out really well. Like, in the beginning, I sat in the back. I didn't say anything. I didn't say hi to anyone, you know. I would go in at the last minute, and then I would, as soon as it was done, I would dip out. But then the more I went, like, the more I kind of got used to it and accepting. And then I started, you know, actually talking a little bit in like meetings and getting to know people and stuff. And it turned out to be a really good resource. I don't think I necessarily need it now. I think I could stop going to AA and I would be fine not drinking, but I keep going. I might not go as often as I used to, but I still go. Because it's, the way I look at it is, going to AA isn't going to hurt me. It's only going to benefit me. Yeah. So why not just follow through with it? And it's like, you know what? I mean, in an hour or so of my time out of a day, you know, here and there, it's like, how many days did I spend time freaking hungover? I've wasted entire days or weekends being hungover or drinking. You know, so I could take one weekend of drinking and being hungover and all that, add all those hours up, and that's probably a year's worth of freaking meetings in one weekend.
Yeah.
So if I just invest a little bit of time and effort into something that's going to help me not drink, it's well worth it to me. And I've had a chance to meet, you know, other veterans there and talk with them and stuff and give them my number. I'm like, listen, you know, if you have any issues, let me know. So the book is just, it's going to be all of our stories of kind of how we went through what we did from like the military, post-military, our struggles, what kind of like brought us to getting sober, and then what life is like in now that we're sober. And just, we want to show other guys that, listen, you know, I know you feel hopeless. Like, I know you might be broke. You're having marital issues. Like, you're having all these things going on. Like, I understand you feel that you are literally living in hell. But, like, it can end. If you quit with the drugs and the alcohol, life will start to get better. It might not seem that way, but it will. And trust me, like, I'm not some, you know, I'm not a doctor shrink that is telling you this because I went to school and that's what they told me. Like, I lived it. I've had a gun to my head. I've been on psych units. I've been on deployments. Like, I've been freaking down the road that you are right now. And there is a way out besides suicide or accepting that you're just condemned to this life of drugs and alcohol, you know? And it's like, and listen, it's not just me. hears these other stories of other guys. And so it's, I want to encourage guys to seek, you know, treatment before it comes to like taking their life, like, you know,
ruining their life, taking their life, ruin their life, ruin other people's lives. Yeah.
And then from there, you know, like even more so, because the VA, like I stopped one time on my way out of the VA, and I was like, out of curiosity, like, do you guys have any kind of alcohol program, like just a meeting, like AA affiliated or anything like that? And the lady wasn't sure, and she had to get up and, you know, go walk around and ask people to then come back and say, no, but we think, you know, your psychiatrist is trying to like start something. And in my mind, you know, I'm like, all right, like, thank you. Like, I wasn't about to give this like shit. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, why isn't there something? Like, it's not like alcohol and drugs is an issue since Iraq and Afghanistan. Like,
no.
It's been an issue for a very, very long. Like, how does the VA not have some sort of, even if it's very informal and guys just, you know, meeting up?
Yeah.
Like something. Because I guarantee if I asked her for the suicide hotline, or if I asked her something about like some homeless program, she'd have been able to give it to me in a heartbeat and knowing right. exactly where it was. But the thing that contributes to both of them, there's 35,000 homeless vets. Is that suck? Yes. People focus on that so much. There's 2.8 million that suffer from substance abuse. Whether I think drugs is like drugs is about 1.1 million. Alcohol is about 1.7 million, and then there's a mixture of both. So you're really concentrated on this 35,000 number, like really concentrated. There's a number of 2.8 million out here that like you don't really hear much about, doesn't really seem to get much attention, but it contributes to that 35,000. And one of my buddies who I was in with was one of those guys that was substance abuse and homeless and stuff. I think a couple of them were actually. So I just sure. like focusing on, you know, getting veterans housing for homeless and stuff like that. Like, that's great. Like, you know, I support those programs, but I want to try and start bringing more attention to the guys that are struggling with drugs and alcohol and trying to catch them before they go to that homeless route, that suicide route, and let them know that, you know, there's other guys out there that have gone through this. There is a way out. Like, you don't need to take your life. Like, I'll put my damn number on the book. Like, you got a problem, call me. I don't care what time of day it is, you can call me, and yeah. I will answer the phone and I will talk to you. But because we don't really want to call like the, you know, the suicide hotline. We don't, like, it's just, we don't want to do that. I'm a lot more likely to call one of my friends from my unit, which I'm still unlikely to do that, than I am the suicide hotline. Now, am I telling guys not to call the suicide hotline? No, by all means, if you need help, call the suicide hotline. For me, I'm just not likely to do that because it's very hard for me to reach out to someone that I feel has no idea what I'm going through. It's a random person on the other end of the phone that doesn't know what it's like to have a bomb go off 3 feet from you, or, you know, freaking be running through a city street and there's a trail of blood and you know it's from your buddy and stuff like that. Like, it, I can't make that connection. So I feel like what you're saying is just gonna fall on deaf ears.
Yeah.
So I just want to make a connection with people and let them know that there's a way out, because I feel like it's just not talked about enough.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys go through it.
Yeah. Few thoughts on that there, Chris. First, about the culture, I've thought about this a lot. I've had my problems with alcohol as well. And I've gone to a couple of AA meetings myself. And one of I remember the guy who invited me, he told me that it was like, this is like midday. It was like noon on a Tuesday or something like that. He said, you know that in Montgomery, in our area here in Montgomery County, there are probably, you know, I don't know how many locations, but there's a shitload of locations that are meeting, you know, several times a day. Mm-hmm. And there, a lot of times there are churches or places like that where you can gather. And he just like just the notion that there, if you could look from a bird's eye view and see all the, like a, almost like a Google Maps, like all the active locations where there are AA meetings that are happening right now. I think that it's not common knowledge to society.
Yeah.
And it should be, because these problems that you're talking about with substance abuse are myriad. They affect everybody. They definitely, because the substance is specifically alcohol, it's ubiquitous. You know, it's friggin' everywhere you turn, every ad, bars, restaurants, barbecues. It's very difficult to get away from. Now, you in the military, it is part of, I think it's part of Americana, and probably every civilization has its, you know, almost like a ceremonial substances, you know, but in the Marine Corps, in the military, that it's like to offset all the aggressive behavior. Like they, on the one hand, they want us to be berserkers, right? To locate and close with the enemy and to, you know, go full throttle, you know, drop of a hat. But how do we balance that when we, in our off time, what are we supposed to do? We're young, as we would say back in the day, young, dumb, and full of cum. You want to just fucking, you want to fight, or you want to fuck, or you want to, you know, seek some kind of adventure. We are not risk averse. We're risk prone. And that's what the American military wants. That's why they say military age male, because they're going to do some stupid shit. Those are the ones you need to be concerned about, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do military age males balance that aggression? Is in my day and in yours, apparently, fucking kicking back with your buddies, drinking beers. I'm sure, as you describe all those experiences and guys you served with, some of the greatest memories that you have involved cutting loose, fucking off in, you know, or going off on deployment, a beer tent or a watering hole or whatever, and laughing, carrying on, beating each other up. I mean, those are some of the greatest memories ever. And so that substance, I feel like it was almost sacred, and like you're endeared to it. It's like, what are we going to do? We got a little bit of time. Hey, can't go home for the weekend. We're going to friggin' pound some beers. Or you come to my room. Hey, come out. I live out in town, and we're, you know, everybody's going to come over there. We're going to have a little party. And so it's everywhere. So it's hard to get away from. And for guys like you and me who are, you know, for lack of a better term, like warrior, you know, the way of the warrior, following the way of the warrior, like the physicality, like the camaraderie, it's even more alluring. So I, myself and everybody I've ever met and served with, that was, they potentially could have had a problem. So the book and people telling their stories and bouncing, you know, relating to one another, that, hey, it doesn't make you, I think one perception is that, oh, well, I can't admit why somebody would not seek help is that because they would be reluctant to admit that they couldn't manage something on their own. Mm-hmm. I can't work myself, like Marine Corps, right? Hey, we're going to go through this obstacle over, under, around, blow a hole in the wall. There's no door, right? So you can't tell me I can't rein this in myself. Oh, I'm hungover. Hey, fuck it, man. I'm going to have a beer, you know, bite the bee that bit me or whatever. So, So it's everywhere, and we're too tough a lot of times and stubborn to admit that defeat in any way. And so, it takes a while before we take any kind of action. Secondly, I wonder what percentage of those, the Marines and, you know, folks you served with that might've said something, they were probably hungover too. I mean, like, it's not impossible. Every officer or staff NCO that I ever met, they probably, the night before, they're probably coming from a party or whatever. And now I got at least a percentage of them that were issuing NJP were out cutting loose with their buddies, whether officers or enlisted, and we're now tasked with reining in the, you know, the young guys. So I think about that and how the issue is not addressed. I think it's because it's so fucking prevalent, man. It's so prevalent.
Right.
And so it definitely is part of the culture. And I don't know how you're going to address it. If enough people speak out, or if you identify with enough guys that you served with that have had the same problem, I bet you everybody say, yeah, me too. So it's really important work that you're doing, man. I can't wait to hear this book and see it brought to fruition. So and you got our support however we possibly can. Had another thought on that. Covering for it. Yeah. Oh, I remember the date. This is, I only served an enlistment, but this is in Okinawa. It's like the last month or whatever, or a couple months of the deployment to Oki. And I picked up Meritorious Sergeant. And I remember at the ceremony, that weekend or whatever, I went out and got tore up. And that Monday, they had a ceremony. I didn't know they were going to do it. But like the battalion commander, company commander, the whole entire chain of command were all assembled. And I had this, like, you know, snapped to the position of attention in front of them. And I was all fucked up. And I remember, like, I left face instead of right face. And I fucking stumbled on the about face. And I looked like a fucking idiot. And I lost some cool points there. But that was part of the, deal, man. I mean, I remember countless times talking about getting up and running PT.
Yeah.
Drunk. That's like almost a point of pride, right?
Yeah.
It was like, yeah, I can do it. Yeah, I ran a 300 PFT today. You know,
Max. When I got kicked out of that sergeant's course, I showed up still intoxicated. And one of my arguments to them was, I can still run a better PFT than 75% of these people, even if I'm intoxicated.
Yeah.
Because it was just, like you said, it's part of what we did.
I can hack it.
Yeah.
I can still hack it. Drunk, I can still run a more. Yeah. I mean, it's
almost like an added challenge to the PFT. Like the physical fitness test isn't enough. Like now I'm going to do it intoxicated just to show you that I'm that good at it.
Yeah. So teach it. It would be great. And I wonder, like, these days, and I'm 30 years removed. But I mean, I remember all the same isms were in place these days. I wonder what kind of strategies the service could employ that could address this and make it, because if they clean this up even moderately, you know, maybe it's, like you said, maybe it's not realistic to expect that young people aren't going to do stupid shit, not going to go out and have a beer. If they can do it responsibly, then that's fine. But I just know way too many people who lose their way doing it. And I've had, I can say that I'm in that group. And so it'd be nice if there was a pathway, some sort. Are MCI still a thing?
They were when I was in.
The Marine Corps Institute, there, viewers. These are little, they were little red books that we all had a stack of. It was like personal finance for Marines, land navigation, yeah. Doing this and that, and then like somebody's wife or whatever in the platoon would do all of them, and then we all get the fucking the answers. So there should be one for like substance abuse for Marines, because
it's important. Probably is, but the problem is, you know, honestly, nobody really puts much value into MCIs. Like I did a good amount of MCIs, and I would just scroll through the book, get the answers, and hand it in.
Yeah. I know what came to mind. Leadership by example. You know, we're devil dogs. We're tough. The the Marine Corps was born in a bar in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was just talking to Chris earlier before we went live. They're rebuilding it. And so I imagine countless Marines gathering there all year round, but especially around 10 November, which is the birthday and the big birthplace of the Marine Corps. And, how do we commemorate it and think of our brothers and our service? And they got a beer tent and they got fucking beans and wieners, and that's what everybody does. But leadership by example is a huge tenet, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to run like you were saying before. You're a section leader. You're training up the new guys. You're sitting back and you're watching them and you're chiming in where they need to, like somebody to adjust you on target. Leadership by example in this regard would be people who have been there, like yourself, you know, and others, talking about their experiences and forewarning young Marines and service personnel. Listen, this is not good. And everybody, I guarantee that audience can all identify with the shit that you're talking about. And so I think this is a great mission that you're on, Chris, and you got my full attention. I hope that this podcast speaks to many others who can relate, and so I'm excited because I think it'll make make us more fit for service. And they say once a Marine, always a Marine. So the service continues.
Like you were saying real quick.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the AA meetings, and just so people out there know, like if you are struggling with alcohol, there's an app, and I forget exactly what it's called, but you can download this app and it will tell you, you put in like your zip code or whatever, and it will tell you meetings around you and like what time they are and stuff. So it's super, super easy to find a meeting. And, you know, like if anybody out there is struggling, like download the app, give it a try. It's not going to hurt you. It's only going to help you. You don't like it, you can't do it, whatever. Like, you know, that's a different story, but you could try it. And the app and the information is out there to get help.
Yeah. So when is your book going to be done?
The target date, as of right now, is by the Marine Corps birthday. So that was something we picked out. So something with that, we're working with a woman / company to do this, because listen, we're grunts. We're not exactly known for our intelligence.
Sure.
But you know, she knows how to write a book and has helped all kinds of people and publish books and stuff like that. So the woman that we're working with, she has a childhood friend that recently passed away. I think just turned 40. Yeah, just turned 40, like last November. Was in the Army, did deployments, got out, had issues with drugs and alcohol, got sober, relapsed, and then was on his way back to rehab to work to get sober again, and had a heart attack and passed away. My guess would be from the relapse. I don't know exactly why. I don't know the circumstances, but I mean, relapse is, you know, hell on your body. And so her seeing that firsthand, as far as, you know, been having a childhood friend in the Army, substance abuse issues, now at the age of 40, like gone. So she became very invested in the project when that happened, not all that long ago. And so through us talking about it, our target date was always like the Marine Corps birthday. So through us talking about it, you know, she said his birthday is November 10th. And I was like, really? I was like, that's awesome. Crazy. Like I struggle to call it a coincidence just because of what our mission is and then her helping us and what happened. And so this guy's birthday turns out to be the target date for the release of this book, which he would be, you know, he would have been primarily like a big target audience, as far as like, hey, you know, you're not the only one out there. Like there's help.
Yeah.
So that's, she's really invested. She's been a huge help in this whole thing.
Let's freaking do it, dude. Do this freaking book. Let's finish the show.
We're working on it. She gives me homework that's long as shit. She gives me more homework than I ever did in high school. Now, granted, I hated high school.
Yeah, me too.
But, she.
Two final thoughts here. And it is the way of the warrior, you know, all the training that you've gone through and all the experience you've had, the deployments, the camaraderie, the missions that you've gone on, all that stuff is relevant. One of the things that I have always strived to do since getting out is, like, you know, they say it persists. You know, it seems like the more time goes by, the more kind of patriotic and reflective we are of our service. So it's in you. And it's in me. And to be able to turn that lens on everything, work, you know, relationships in a productive way, to be on a mission and to pursue something and apply the same kind of strategies that we did in stopping at nothing to accomplish an objective in the Corps, to do that, you know. So how bad anus would it be if you were, for again, had like set up a table at the Marine Corps birthday when they got fucking kegs and beans and wieners and all that shit. Seriously. So, I mean, that's leadership by example, bro. That is like, hey, you know, because there's in that crowd, there's shitloads of guys who have a problem or have faced their demons and are okay showing up. We should be able to show up and not partake and still be able to, you know, celebrate our service and carry the flag for this important mission that affects so many, man, because we want these guys to stick around.
That's a great point. I might
that's
might
a good idea
to do something like
nobody because yeah. nobody would do that, because it's like, and it's not like you're raining on a parade, but it's like, hey, there's a presence here. Fucking this is an issue. You want to be around next year for the Marine Corps birthday?
Right.
So that would be awesome. And I believe, I mean, I know that they typically celebrate at Cookies. Now it's a different name, yeah. But you been down there for that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's mayhem.
You know, last time I was down there, was two guys stripped their shirts off. They're trying to kill each other. You know, I had a, it's fucking crazy. I have a friend who, she was like a first sergeant or something like that. And in the reserves, and she's like, yeah, I'll see you down there. I would always say, I'll see you down there. My brother's gonna be there. He was a Marine, da 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 da, this year. And so he's down there. I see him saying hello. He's got a bottle, and all of a sudden, like an hour goes by, I turn around, there's a commotion. He freaking passed out, cracked his head on the freaking sidewalk, and an ambulance pulls up. It was just fucking sad, man. So yeah. The guy spent, rather than celebrating his service, he wound up going in the ER, lost many cool points, and then it's like, that didn't need to fucking happen. We don't need to celebrate like that, you know, to that extreme. So, but that sort of shit will happen. And so it's great to be able to put an end to that or to address it. It's important work you're doing, man. So with that, Chris, I appreciate your time, my brother.
Yeah.
Love and respect.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
We're going to friggin' spread the good word about the mission you're on. And I want to see that book brought to a completion, man. It's going to be friggin' fierce.
Yeah.